Well, next two Sundays will be the last two Sundays Laurie and I are able to be here, and I'm going to be talking from the book of Matthew, chapter 5, 6, 7-ish, the Sermon on the Mount. And so prepare yourselves over the next week, 2 weeks, and read through the Sermon on the Mount a couple times. I'm not going to tell you what I'm going to speak on, that way it would give it away. But Sermon on the Mount. And also the last Sunday, we're going to switch it up because we missed a lot of stuff at Christmas time. We missed Christmas Eve. We missed Boxing Day. We missed communion. So on the last Sunday of this month, we are going to have communion. And Laurie and I are going to serve you. And we want to be part of your community for that last Sunday. And it's going to be done a little bit different. So you can prepare yourselves for that as well. So that's the next two Sundays coming up. On Sabbath, Old Testament Hebrew people gathered to hear the law and to sing poetry and to listen to new oracles and recite prayers. And they did this to renew their faith. They did this to refresh their spirit, to celebrate their heritage, to rekindle their hope in the future. It was sort of a weekly exercise and spiritual renewal. Today, though, is a very special Sabbath. Their beloved king, King David, he's going to unveil a new poem, a new song to sing. The nation anticipated these times, and he told them they were coming because when it came to poetry and theology and pulling those two things together, everyone recognized David to be one of the finest. His previous masterpieces had become literary pieces to be memorized, marveling his audiences. And they would be used in private celebrations of their faith. They would be used in community celebrations of their faith. They were just that excellent, and they would last for generations. And so David moves among his community, and he takes his place, and he prepares to deliver his newest creation. Months of artistry and is about to be spoken. All the drafts have been pushed aside and destroyed, and all that's left is the final copy. And the time comes, and the congregation falls silent, and David begins. It's in your bulletin. Ascribe to the Lord, O mighty ones, ascribe to the Lord glory and strength. Ascribe to the Lord the glory due his name. Worship the Lord in the splendor of his holiness. The voice of the Lord is over the waters. The God of glory thunders. The Lord thunders over the mighty waters. The voice of the Lord is powerful. The voice of the Lord is majestic. The voice of the Lord breaks the cedars. The Lord breaks in pieces the cedars of Lebanon. He makes Lebanon skip like a calf, Syrian like a young wild ox. The voice of the Lord strikes with flashes of lightning. The voice of the Lord shakes the desert. The Lord shakes the desert of Kadesh. The voice of the Lord twists the oaks and strips the forest bare. And all in his temple cry, one more time, and all in his temple cry, the Lord sits enthroned over the flood. The Lord is enthroned as king forever. The Lord gives strength to his people. The Lord blesses his people with peace. And the song comes to a conclusion. And first there's silence, and then the congregation erupts into a spontaneous, thunderous applause. David has done it again, unveiling a masterpiece of literary and theological genius, filled with intense emotion and vibrant images. This poem, upon its first reading, is nothing less than spectacular, but everyone knows it will take many more readings and much more time to unravel the subtle nuances of truth entwined in these crafted phrases. Yes, David has done it again, and the applause diminishes to pious reflection. And this poem, this song, psalm, rightfully makes its way into the Hebrew anthology of favorite hymns and now finds its place in what we know it as Psalm 29. And as a New Testament community of faith, we're going to take the opportunity to unpack some of the incredible theology and imagery and literary genius crammed into these short 22 lines of a Hebrew poem. And by doing so, our hope is to catch a fresh glimpse of our powerful God, our one and only God. Recognize that peace in life, something for which we all crave, comes from only one place, and that's our awesome, powerful God. And take away a renewed passion to worship our one and only awesome, powerful God. That's where we want to go. And so just as the New Testament or the Old Testament people gathered to renew their faith and to refresh their spirit, we gather. Whether we're sitting here or watching on a computer, we gather as the church to renew our faith and to refresh our spirit. So first, a very quick word about Old Testament Hebrew poets and poetry. This is going to be like I know there's lots of teachers out there, and you can grade me. You're now the super teacher sitting at the back, and you're grading the teacher up the front, and you're going to tell me what I did right and what I did wrong. And so this is going to be sort of a lesson on how to teach your teaching. So we're going to talk about Hebrew poets and poetry, and Psalm 29 is a Hebrew poem. It's a song to be sung. And these psalms were often set to music and used in liturgical worship. And the authors of the psalm not only loved God, but also loved the literary and artistic form of poetry. And Hebrew poets were skilled architects of words and phrases and poetic conventions. And they were masters at handling their language with magnificent creativity. And these poems were nothing less than a festival of artistic beauty. And they were written with emotion to evoke emotion, and they were written to develop a mood and call for an appropriate response. And Psalm 29 is no exception. Hopefully you caught some emotion as we read through there. It's a masterpiece. And we're reading in English. We miss a lot from the translation from the Hebrew. They've done their best to bring it to us in the English, but it was originally written in Hebrew. We can only imagine the artistry that is happening in the Hebrew. I don't know Hebrew very well at all, and maybe you do. But there's so many dynamic things happening in this poem, it's quite difficult to tame. And so we'll start by just identifying three overall themes. And the first theme is this. Psalm 29 is basically a rant. It's like Rick Mercer on CBC when he walks down that graffitied wall and he looks at the camera and he just keeps talking. He's ranting. He's upset about something. He's trying to make a point, and he's trying to get that out, communicated out to the world. And this is what David is doing. He's ranting. It's a rant against polytheism. It's a rant against that people are choosing to have more than one God in their lives. The plurality of gods. That's what polytheism means. And David was angry. And he was angry at his people because they were choosing to add more gods to their own real God. And gods were piling up when God shouldn't have been piling up at all. And David rants, there is only one God. There is only one powerful God. There is one and only one all-powerful God who has the grace to stoop down and grant peace to his people. There is no other, invent no other, seek no other. We could go home now. We learned something. But that's just step one. We'll get back to that theme. The step point two, or the second theme, is the storm. We've been talking this morning about storms. And most of us have experienced the dynamic of an extreme storm hitting our house or hitting us or hitting whatever we're in. And we've seen the southeasters come off the Pacific or the Ontario thunderstorm or a lightning storm or closer to home recently, the atmospheric river storms. And the storm begins sort of quietly in the distance, the calm before the storm. And then maybe a rumble of thunder in the distance, and it comes closer and closer and closer. The sky gets darker and lightning flashes, lighting up the horizon. And then it hits. It hits with the unleashed power of wind and rain and hail, wreaking havoc until it subsides into calm serenity and peacefulness and moves away. And Psalm 29 is structured like a powerful Mediterranean storm building up over the sea, moving in, hitting landfall with immense energy and destruction, and then receding back to stillness and peace. That's how the psalm is structured. Three stanzas. And then the third theme, I'll call it the last word. I've been on many church boards in my life, and we, in our church in Prince Rupert, our leadership team was there, and we had one particular individual who always chose to speak last. And he had determined that the last word is the word most considered. While there are many phrases and things happening in this poem, when it's all said and done, the poet finishes with one comforting, lasting, impressionable word. Peace. Shalom. A word that is very precisely placed by the author. And here's what David wants the community to come to rest on, that the one and only all-powerful God offers his creation peace like no one can offer, but in reality, he is the only one who can offer it because there is only one God. So we'll get back to that theme. So we want to pull all these creative pieces together and see what Paul's trying to do here, or Paul. His name's David, not Paul. Paul was his brother, I think. So start with a rhetorical question. A teaching moment here. As you have heard the poem and glance back at your handout, who is this poem about? All at once. The Lord. Thank you. Very good. Rhetorical question. You already know the answer. What and who is the object? It's the Lord. It's quite obvious. As I read that, 18 out of 22 lines have the word the Lord in it. And you will notice that the Lord is spelt with capital L-O-R-D. And in the Old Testament, when you see the word Lord, L-O-R-D, in capital letters, that's referring to the pre-incarnate Jesus Christ. Not God the Father, not God the Holy Spirit, Jesus Christ, the creator of the universe. And the Lord is mentioned 18 times out of 22 lines. And the author wanted to know, beyond the shadow of a doubt, this poem is all about God. Because he's going to be talking about other things, but he wants you to make no mistake. The object of this poem is Jesus Christ, is the Lord. 18 times the Lord rings into the ears of the hearer. And this is by deliberate design. Repetition is a favorite literary device in Hebrew poetry. When something is said once, it means something. When it's said twice, oh, we better pay attention. If it's said three times, wow, we really should pay attention. I had a friend who worked for the police down in North Vancouver. If he got an email, he ignored it. If he got it for the second time, he thought about it. If he got it the third time, okay, I better answer it. That's sort of what's happening here. 18 times, though, not three. The Lord, the Lord, the Lord, the Lord. Who's it talking about? The Lord. Might seem simple, but he had to get through to his people. I want to talk to you about God. And here it's used in an extreme, this repetition, for a good reason, because the people were running into this issue or messing around with other gods. They were influenced by their surrounding culture, in particular the Canaanites. The Canaanites were a polytheistic society. The Canaanites had developed a god for every eventuality in life, and they covered every aspect of life, and they invented a god if they felt they needed a god for that particular part of their life. And just to be on the safe side, why put all your eggs in one basket with just one? No, we didn't have a whole bunch, just in case. So spread the God responsibility around. Maybe that one God can't handle the whole God responsibility. Maybe he needs a helper. So this whole concept of just one God, well, why not make more? And David digs in and he says, sorry, there's only one. There's only one and an all-powerful God. You don't need anyone else. So eliminate this notion that there's other gods around there, because it's just not acceptable. We can't go down that road. And he must bring his nation back to the truth of a one and only one God. And in his rant, David deliberately picks on a popular, well-known Canaanite god by the name of Baal. In Sunday school, we used to call him Baal. But if you pronounce it a little bit better, although it's probably not perfect, Baal. And he doesn't hold back in using extreme satire to the point of mocking this false deity. He's not nice to him, even though he doesn't exist. And he doesn't hold back from using this extreme satire. And satire was another literary device used in Hebrew poetry. And David uses it well. Baal in the Canaanite culture was depicted as being half ox and half man. His ox half was large and powerful, and his man half was threatening and intimidating. He's depicted as this hairy, chested, bearded, muscular, mean-looking beast of a man, much like not me. And in one of his outstretched arms flashes large lightning bolts, and so he's this awesome, intimidating figure, but not real. And so this mythological Baal was supposed to be the god of nature. And Baal was supposed to have the ability to bring good weather and a bountiful harvest because of the good weather. And if you have a bountiful harvest, you have peace. You have calm. Because if you not have enough food to eat, you're a lot more peaceful than if you don't. And if your harvest fails, your life is miserable and anything but peaceful. So each year prior to the planting season, the Canaanite people would go out into the hills and they would try to pacify Baal. They would pray and they would dance and they would sacrifice and they would plead and they would beg and tickle his ears in hopes that Baal would be gracious enough to give to his puny subjects a bumper crop. And they looked to Baal for peace. What are we looking for in life? Peace. They looked to Baal for peace. And so using these finely crafted conventions, David elevates the Lord, the one and only one God, to a completely dominant position over all of creation and over all supposed competitors in the God department, including Baal. So using these three stanzas, David presents the raw dominant power of the real God. And these stanzas mimic a storm. It builds over in the side and it crashes on landfall and then it subsides. The three stanzas, build, crash, subside. There's a storm approaching in stanza one. There's a storm unleashing in stanza two. There's a storm de-escalating to calmness and peace in stanza three. A common literary structure used by the Hebrew people was a thing called parallelism, where one line matches another line. And it's a very, very common Hebrew poetry literary device. And in the first stanza, the literary device of parallelism is intact. Line one matches line two, and line three matches line four. They say the same thing. In some way, they are connected. Everything is orderly. Everything is fine. Everything is going along as it should. And then in the second stanza, the parallelism breaks down. No line matches another line. You can't see it in English per se, but in the Hebrew, it's there. And while the order of stanza one is intact, the chaos of stanza two becomes very clear. Back to the first stanza. What's the first word that he uses? It's ascribe. What's the word he uses in the second line? Ascribe. What's the third word he uses in the third line? a scribe. A scribe is sort of like, well, give credit where credit is due. Okay, give some credence to what is being said here. And so on, in just used on its own, it's sort of a passive word, a scribe. But then he uses it three times. A scribe, a scribe, a scribe. The language is building. The language is heightening. And then he goes, no, wrong word. Worship! And worship is at the absolute extreme of giving anyone credit. You can't go beyond worship. A scribe, a scribe, a scribe. No, 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 wrong word. Worship the Lord. So the people would have been picking up on this. They would be picking up on the intensity building. They would be picking up on the language intensifying. Worship the Lord is where he ends stanza one. And then he gets to stanza two where this catastrophic storm is unleashed. Parallelism breaks down. Control is lost. The storm is wreaking havoc on the land. It leaves a path of destruction in its wake. It's snapping huge trees like twigs. Tsunami flooding the lands. Wreaking havoc on established old growth forests. On a horrific, frightening display of raw power. And as a human witnesses what's going on here, witnesses this catastrophic event, he has no other response but that one word that we shouted out, glory. Wow. Amazing. It's not calming, but it's amazing. Maybe even shouting out, oh my God, which is an appropriate place to use that statement. And then he sort of built this climax in stanza one. He's unleashed a storm in stanza two. And then in stanza three, he sort of brings it down again. The parallelism in Hebrew is back. Line one matches line two. Line three matches line four. The calm after the storm. Everything settled down. Peace is restored. And the language that is used in this stanza is much more calming. Is much more peaceful. The tone of the song is of this psalm is anything but peaceful. And yet he chooses to end with this word peace, that this internal welling up that everything is under control. Yes, God is omnipotent. God is all-powerful. Let me demonstrate by the illustration of a storm, and yet in contrast, our one and only God of omnipotence has the amazing power to bless us with what the core we seek in every day of our lives, and that's to live in peace. Is a poem sort of coming alive a little bit in your mind? We're just starting. We go back to David's rant against polytheism. The Hebrews and the Canaanites were moving in a direction of choosing more gods, many god position. And David is out to stomp out that heresy. If you look at line number one, way back up in line number one, the first line, he talks about, O mighty ones. Ascribe to the Lord, O mighty ones. What's he talking about? Who are the mighty ones of our universe? Sun, moon, stars, planets, galaxies. These are what we would consider, what they would have considered the mighty ones. And typically, many cultures take the sun and the moon and the stars and the planets and they make them into gods because they're mysterious. They don't know what really they're all about and they have this intense spiritual mystique. And what does David do? He says, mighty ones, worship the true God, because there's only one. You aren't a God. Some people might make you that, but you're not. There's only one God. So worship that one God. You're the created. Worship the Creator. And so he calls on the greatest of creation, the mighty ones, to turn and worship their Creator. Then he goes back to Baal. Let's go back to Baal for a moment. I like this guy. He's kind of big and ferocious. And mythology held that if he was in a good mood, he would help people out. But if he wasn't in a good mood, then he would do what he wanted. And so David reels in this heresy about this guy, and he does it in a very interesting way. He talks about the voice of the Lord. And he talks about the voice of the Lord being thunder and lightning. What's Baal shooting out of his fingers? Lightning. He's just sort of making fun of him. The voice of the Lord can speak by making a mountain range dance and move. And can you do that, Baal? No, you can just calm storms. I can make mountains move. The voice of the Lord, it shakes the deserts and rips apart mighty trees. And he talks about not someone doing that, but someone being that, and God is actually that. And the Hebrew people would have quickly picked up of the analogy comparing this mythological Baal to God. Another thing that we can look at is the word strength. In line 2, there's the word strength used. It's underlined. I underlined it for you. In the second last line, the word strength is used. It's underlined. We call that an inclusio, or bookends. And whenever in a Hebrew poem you see two words at the end of a poem that are matching, that means something. It means they're bookends, and you need to look into the middle to see what they're talking about. So he talks about strength, and then he talks about strength. Okay, look in the middle, verses 6 and 7. You'll find a demonstration of strength. Verse 6 is the middle. It says, he makes Lebanon skip like a calf and Syrian like a young wild ox. Lebanon and Syrian, in this particular context, are mountain ranges. He makes this mountain range of Lebanon just jump around. That's how powerful our God is. But when you see this couplet of verse 6, when you see that couplet of right in the center, you understand that is sort of where he's driving. That's where he's sort of going. He says to the people, you want to look at this Baal guy. Then he goes, if you want to see a God of power and strength over nature, then look closely. The true, completely unique, one and only God can make mountain ranges like Lebanon and Syrian dance like a calf, like a young wild ox. Like a young wild ox, like a calf. Who is Baal depicted as? A fierce bull. And David's picking on him and saying, in the eyes of God, you're just this young, whimpering, fledgling little calf. You're a nothing. Even if you did exist, which you don't, you're a nothing. And then the community would immediately realize that he was deliberately taking a huge satirical jab at this Baal. The one and only God had the ability to make mythological gods like Baal dance like puppet strings, and all other supposed gods are just immature nothings. You look at stanza 2, the voice of the Lord is mentioned 7 times. 7 in Hebrew culture was a number of perfection, completeness. God is complete. He doesn't need anyone else. How many lines are in this poem? We've done this before. 22. How many Hebrew characters are in the Hebrew alphabet? 22. Another indication of completeness. God stands alone. Who's the object of the poem? God. He stands alone. He needs no other. So don't look for any other. Don't invent any other. He's got the God department completely covered. You don't need anyone else. Stanza 3, let's talk about kings. David was highly revered in his community. He was their king. He was their so highly revered to some point that some may have considered him a god. He's so good. He could be God. And David comes away and he says, sorry, the king sits enthroned. I worship that king. I bow down to that king. I bow down to that God. I'm not him. Don't look to me as a god. I'm not even close. And then he finishes with this last word, the very last word of the poem, carefully chosen, carefully placed, holding incredible significance. Peace. All this about God, using the contrast of this angst, anxiety-filled storm, is the very God that can move into your life and grant you peace. I'm so powerful, I am so powerful, I can give you peace. Where else can you find peace? So as we wrap it up, this psalm is high emotion, very unsettling. It has a sense of confusion and fear and the unleashing of God's power. Storms are so unpredictable. Storms are so violent and destructive. How much peace has been presented in this poem to this point? Very little. And that's where he wants us to go. Contrast to make a point, another literary device. Without God at the helm of our life, how much peace do we experience? If we look back to verse number 6, the center, what he's saying there is that Baal guy, he doesn't exist. So take him out of the center and put me in. What gods do we have to take out of the center of our lives to allow God to be placed in his proper position? So all this packed away in 22 lines of a Hebrew poem, artistry at its best. What can we do with it all? What can we do 3,000 years later? I'm going to give you 3 suggestions at what this poem is trying to point out in a practical way. If we choose to seek peace in our heart and soul from any other source, we're going to be greatly disappointed. Pick a god. Pick any god. It, he, she will fail the peace test in a big way. How about the God of financial stability? Is that God able to offer you peace? Financial stability is only secure as the global economy and it's precarious at best. A proper approach to financial stability is to view it as a gift, not a God. A gift to be stewarded for the cause of the kingdom of God. The Lord blesses his people with peace far beyond what money has to offer. Peace that moves beyond this life and into an eternity. How about the God of health? Is that God able to offer peace? Health can be ripped away at a moment's notice. And a proper approach to health is to view it as a gift, not a God. A gift to be stewarded for the cause of the kingdom of God. When it comes to health, something that can easily replace the rightful place of God in our lives, we are challenged to understand the Lord blesses his people with peace far beyond what health can offer. A peace that moves beyond this life and into eternity. How about the God of relationships, the God of family? These gods, these can become gods, invading the center of our heart and soul. Are these gods able to offer peace? Relationships are as precarious as any other god we may choose to create, ripped away at a moment's notice. And relationships need to be recognized, and family needs to be recognized as gifts, not gods. Gifts to be stewarded for the cause of the kingdom of God. And when it comes to valued relationships, something that can easily replace the rightful place of God in our lives, we are challenged to understand the Lord blesses his people with peace far beyond the deepest relationship in our life. A peace that moves beyond this life and into an eternity. And so since God is the only true and lasting peace, he deserves nothing less than full on, full out, go for broke, rock music worship. We are challenged to orient our lives, our entire lives, in such a way that God is the center, taking out what's replacing him, moving it over here, and putting him back in, the one and only, because there is only one. Seek no other, invent no other, worship no other.